Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the 1977 first edition Advanced Dungeons & Dragons Monster Manual. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in it. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we continue our journey through the S section of the Monster Manual, and that means we're going to be talking about a lot of aquatic monsters. Again. But before we do any of that, it's time to thank a new Patreon backer. This is someone who's gone to patreon.com/monsterman and pledged as little as $1 a month to support the show. And if, like today's backer, you pledge at the $2 or higher level, you'll also get access to my new podcast, Patron Deities, in which I do for the Deities and Demigods book what I'm doing for the Monster Manual, only with a little more depth, using it as a springboard to talk about world mythology and about using religion and the divine in your games. So thank you very much to Robin Fahey. Is it Fahey? Is it Fahey? I don't know. Thanks anyway, Robin. I appreciate it. All right, let's get started. Our first monster for today is the Scorpion, Giant. This one's a winner. I don't think anyone needs explaining why a Scorpion, Giant is a great thing to have your D&D characters run into, and it's largely to do with the fact that we are kind of disproportionately afraid of scorpions. We don't like them. There's something about the way they move, something about the way that they sting that seems unnatural to us, even more unnatural than the spider. But I think that the spider and the scorpion would be less frightening to us if they didn't have such strange gimmicks. The spider's web, the scorpion's sting, they just seem like things that animals sort of ought not to be able to do. And that gives them a little sense of the unnatural. The Scorpion Common Giant does sort of exemplify some of the randomness of earlier versions of D&D. I mean, he's got a save versus poison or drop dead attack, which is fine. I mean, again, a certain amount of randomness is part of the game, and, you know, you so stay away from that sting, I guess. But that is interesting considering that he is not otherwise a super powerful monster. And so I assume that what you're going to get is player characters coming up with all sorts of clever strategies to protect themselves from the scorpion sting or luring the scorpion into environments where it can't use its sting effectively. At least that's what I'd like to think, rather than just a bunch of people randomly dying and then grousing about it. Okay, so the Scorpion Common Giant, he's pretty great. He lurks in ruined temples, he stings people with his sting, he nips people with his nippers, he does it all. Next up, we have a bunch of nautical-themed monsters, or aquatic monsters, starting with the Sea Hag. Now, the Sea Hag has a reasonably good bit. She is a terrifying old sort of witch-like creature who lives in dark, dank, seaweedy kind of environments. She only lives in places that are ugly. She hates beauty and light. And she is, in fact, so ugly that first she frightens you, but also she can hit you with her evil glare, which again forces you to save or fall down dead. Now, what's a little weird to me is that there are multiple hags in this game, but they're not very closely connected to each other. So other than being sort of a witch type, the Sea Hag is not really very similar to the Night Hag. The Sea Hag is also not very similar to probably the most famous Sea Hag in popular culture, which is the Sea Hag in Popeye. We tend to think that Popeye's main antagonist is Brutus or Bluto, depending on how you want to think about it. But really kind of the main Popeye villain, if such a thing can be said to exist, in E.C. Seeger's Thimble Theater and later Popeye, was the Sea Hag. And the Sea Hag is the last witch on Earth and a pirate queen, and she has a bunch of lions that she keeps on her island, and she's in love with Popeye, and she keeps trying to steal him away from Olive Oil through a series of increasingly bizarre schemes. And because Popeye is a gentleman, he would never hit a lady, so the stories always basically end with the Sea Hag getting beaten up by Olive Oil. I gotta say that compared to the last witch on Earth who is a pirate queen, a lady so ugly that she kills you by looking at you is a little bit of a letdown, but I still think the Sea Hag has a place. I do think it's interesting that later editions of D&D rolled the Sea Hag into the Night Hag and just created a generic hag group with sort of specializations in it, and moved the Sea Hag much closer to the Night Hag's role as a spellcaster, coven leader, whatever, and less as this kind of almost feral creature that we see here in the Monster Manual. Then we have the Sea Horse. Now, okay, let's talk terminology. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to establish one thing here and then just violate it in the next monster entry. So if you think back all the way to the H section, you will remember the hippocampus. The hippocampus has the tail of a fish and the forward part of the body and the legs and head of a horse. And it's sort of a heraldic creature that appears in coats of arms and medieval art and so on. And the name hippocampus, in modern scientific terminology, is applied to the seahorse and to a region of the brain that is kind of shaped a bit like a seahorse. So the seahorse is a seahorse, that is the little fish with the kind of funny-looking horse-shaped head. Is it technically a fish? I genuinely don't know. Which is, in scientific parlance, called a hippocampus, but is not the same as the monster called the hippocampus, which is what is more conventionally referred to as a seahorse. Clear? Good. The seahorse, I don't know. I get the idea that you kind of ride around on them. The thing about the seahorses is they look so weird when they're swimming because of their odd upright posture, and that makes them really compelling, but it also makes it feel strange when a character is riding one. The person most associated with riding on a seahorse is probably Aquaman. Aquaman was always riding around on a seahorse, and it looks a bit daft. I got nothing against Aquaman, I'm not one of those people, but the seahorse, I don't know, I feel like that's a... visually, that's kind of a strange look. Now, again, there's nothing wrong with that. You could definitely include that in your D&D game. It just sort of depends on what your undersea kingdom is going to look like. And by having people riding around on seahorses, you're definitely making a particular choice about what the aesthetic of that undersea kingdom is going to be, one that's going to be difficult to then go back on. It's a little bit like including some of the other kind of more whimsical medieval heraldic monsters in your game. You're making a certain kind of statement about your game's aesthetic that's it's then going to be weird if you add in a bunch of grisly horror monsters, unless you're going for the full gonzo. Not that I don't advocate going for the full gonzo, but it's a specific aesthetic choice that you need to be prepared for the consequences of. Speaking of the full gonzo, we have the sea lion. Now, this is not the sea lion, the species of, are they pinnipeds? The species of marine mammals that are like seals except for the shape of their tails and fins is different. This is a sea lion. That is to say, the heraldic sea lion with the tail of a fish and the head of a lion and the forepaws of a lion. And it has a great illustration that shows a couple of sea lions eating up a shark. And actually, I think they're pretty terrific. I mean, they're just another marine predator, so the odds of them coming up in a typical game are pretty slight. As I've had cause to mention before, there are a lot of water monsters in this book, and probably more than I would expect get used in a lot of D&D games, because most D&D games are pretty focused on, for want of a better word, dungeons. But you can definitely see a couple of these things floating in a snarling pack around the King of Atlantis as he sits on his seaweed-covered throne on the ocean bed and passes judgment on you, the wretched air breathers who plundered the tombs of his ancestors. You can see the reasons for using them, but yet again, they definitely tell you here we are in the medieval marginalia game. You know, a little bit like the cockatrice in that respect. If you've got a cockatrice in your game, and you're going the full cockatrice, you know, it's a snake chicken, we know a little something about what kind of game we're in. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's a strong aesthetic choice. I do feel that it's a little confusing that there's a sea lion, and that it is different from the sea lion. And considering the obsessive cataloging of different animal species by the Monster Manual, I really am quite surprised that there are neither seals nor sea lions in this book. I mean, I recognize that you may be not very likely to be attacked by a sea lion, but you're also not very likely to be attacked by a warthog or a dolphin, and they're both in here. So that seems odd that there's a sea lion, but no sea lion. So yeah, again, I think the heraldic monsters are fun. I think the goofiness of the giant seahorse that people ride around on is fun. I think the sea hag is quite good, but would be better if she were more individualized. So I think you have to say, you know, that's not a sea hag, that's the sea hag, the mad old woman who, you know, lives in this thing, and she has a vengeance against the world because her son was a sailor and he drowned, and now she hates everybody, and, you know, she lives in that old ruined lighthouse and she preys on people and no one goes near, but she knows some secret that we need, or she knows the location of the sunken treasure or whatever it might be, right? You have to contextualize the sea hag in a way that maybe you don't with the scorpion comma giant, who carries all of its awesome right there on the outside. So a pretty good crop of monsters in this episode. I'm particularly attached to the Scorpion Comet Giant because just such a good utility monster. Everybody likes a Scorpion Comet Giant, everybody's afraid of a Scorpion Comet Giant, and everyone feels that the presence of a Scorpion Comet Giant reinforces their sense of heroic adventure and danger. But the others are pretty good too. Sea Hag, probably the best of the bunch, but overall a pretty solid crop here. Next time, we're going to take a look at a pretty good mix of monsters. We're going to have some actual dangerous wildlife, we're going to have a creature inspired by a comic book, and we're going to have the sinister Shadow. So please join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monsterman, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the deities and demigods advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.